This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 270 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by co-host Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Well, good evening. And you know, I don't feel 270. I mean, I know I'm an old guy now, but that really makes me feel even older than I am.
That's a lot of episodes, huh?
It is a lot. You know what? We've been doing this a long time, and it's still a lot of fun, isn't it?
And that's what's most important.
That's right.
Well, our other co-host, David Vanderhoof, from the What Just Flew By blog, is winding his way home from Canada as we record this. So he won't be joining us, but he will be recording an aircraft of the week, and then we're going to insert that in later before we publish this episode. So you will hear from David, but not live with us. Let's see. Do we know what the airplane is? I think we do.
It'll be the Vickers Viscount.
The Vickers Viscount. Okay, so that'll be the airplane of the week when David finally makes it back home?
I used to call it the Viscount when I was a kid, but a couple of years ago I changed that.
Well, that's how it's spelled. But
yeah, I know.
Okay. All right. Well, Rob, do you want to introduce our guest for this episode?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're going to talk about a new book that is out, Understanding Air France 447, which is a topic that's something I've been following for a long time because I'm also a safety geek, and we just happen to be lucky enough to have a fellow tonight that wrote the book, a fellow I've known for years, and I have to be honest, Bill Palmer, who is our guest tonight, who a captain for a major air carrier here in the States on the A330, and I have known each other for a while because he used to visit Jetwine.com quite a bit when the aerodynamic discussions became really intense, and I learned early on years ago that Bill knew what he was talking about. So we've had many conversations over the years about this. And Bill, I'm really pleased to welcome you to the Airplane Geeks tonight.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, we'll see if you still feel that way at the end of the show. I mean, you can change your mind.
Okay. So we'll leave that option open.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think you're dialing in from beautiful San Diego tonight, which is a nice warm climate, unlike... Well, that's right. We're not supposed to talk about the weather anymore. But Bill, so we're going to talk about your book a little bit, but just tell us briefly what your book is about.
My book is about understanding all the factors behind the Air France 447 crash, because I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned from it, and a lot of pilots need to benefit from those lessons. My primary initial target was other Airbus pilots, but it grew as the audience apparently increased as, you know, the production of the book came along. So it's written so that any aviation enthusiast could easily grasp it. And my family members who are not even aviation enthusiasts will tell you that they can even grasp it as well. So it's a pretty wide audience as far as understanding it. But the lessons are particularly applicable for pilots.
Well, I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion tonight about Air France 447, as well as the state of training for commercial pilots and a few other interesting topics. But first, Max, I think we have some news, don't we?
Yeah, we do. We have some news from this week. We're going to talk about what Boeing is doing in the larger airplane end of the spectrum. Talk about a suit against United Airlines, something about frequent flyer rewards programs being rigged. We also have some interesting information about Mooney. Mooney hasn't produced aircraft in, what, Rob, maybe about 5 years or so?
About that.
Yeah, well, it looks like They may be coming back to life. We're going to talk about overhead bins on the airliners and the struggle to find space. Maybe a few other news topics along the way. We've also got an Australia desk report. Turns out Steve and Grant were on hand for the delivery of Jetstar's first Boeing 787 Dreamliner. They're going to talk to us about that. They had an opportunity to speak with the CEO of Jetstar Australia New Zealand. That was David Hall. And then on his Across the Pond segment, Peter Johnson talks to an aircraft designer, Francois Devatville, about a new airliner that he's designed. And then we've got some listener mail that we'll look forward to at the end of the show. So how's that sound, Rob?
Sounds good. And we're only going to read the good listener mail this week, right? Not the whiners and complainers. And actually, we're pretty lucky. We don't really have.
No, we have a lot of good. In fact, we have a little bit of listener mail held over, carried over from last week that we didn't have time to get to. So hopefully we can get to everybody. Our first story is from Business Week. Boeing unveils its jumbo killer. Now, this is about the 777X. Boeing does not have board approval to offer the 777X yet. However, they do have an order from Lufthansa for 34 aircraft, and they're rolling along. Now, Boeing really needs something to replace the outdated 747-400. Four engines, of course. Twins are the way to go when it comes to large aircraft, particularly operating economics. And so Boeing is looking to enlarge the 777, initially with 50 seats, to give it some efficiencies over the 747-400, but also over the A380. First model is the -9X. Which is going to carry about 400 passengers, maybe more. A little bit bigger than the Airbus A350 with a range of around 8,000 nautical miles. So, Rob, here we go again with another new airplane.
9,400 nautical miles. That's something I thought was very interesting on one of the variants of this 777-9Ms. I mean, Bill, if you had a trip of 9,400 nautical miles at cruise, how many hours of flying is that?
We're talking in the 18-hour range.
Wow. I can't even stay up that long. But that's
going to
be
a long-haul flight.
That is a long flight. What I still am wondering, I have a friend that flies for another major airline, not the major airline captain we have on board with us today flies for, but another major airline that is based in Chicago that is going to go nameless. But and she flies a 777, and she calls it the light twin. So I just think that's kind of funny because she was a 400 pilot. But Bill, do you know offhand, it for the companies that are going to have 777s like this, are they going to be taking these things polar, or do you think the two engines across the pole is going to be too scary?
I don't know.
Well, that was easy.
I'm sorry. It's okay. I don't have details on that. I mean, I think there are some routes that go very close to the poles. I know I just found out that the A330 is, at least on our route structure, is not supposed to go over the pole with it, but pretty sure that it can. So I'm sorry, I don't know the details on
it. I'm just curious, why wouldn't they? Is it because it's a twin that they don't want to take it across the poles? Or is there some other particular reason on that?
I don't know. I'm not sure when you're over the pole how close the nearest suitable alternate is, but I would think that Thule would be within 180 minutes. I don't know. I don't know what the technical issue is.
Okay. I was just curious. Well, anyway, Max, back to you, since our guest has left me hanging out here with no answer.
Well, there's some interesting technology on this 777X, on these larger variants. For one thing, they're going to use the wing from the 787, the composite wing, a little bit longer. It's going to have a 233-foot span, which is pretty enormous. But an interesting thing is they're going to hinge the wingtips so that they'll actually fold up as they're taxiing and at the gates, which will decrease the width of the aircraft. The reason for that is that you then don't need wider taxiways or specially designed wide gates or even two gates. Some aircraft that are on the large size will take up two gates if they're that wide. So there's a cost advantage to that. And I don't think I certainly can't remember any commercial aircraft that's had folding wings or folding wingtips. Have you guys ever run across anything like that?
I don't think I've ever seen one like that. But, of course, no. This is the first era where we've had aircraft with wingspans of this kind of width. Obviously, it's wider than a 747, and people thought that was big. But I think the issue for them is that it means the end of the 747, most likely.
Yeah, and I think that's what Boeing has in mind. I think that's what Lufthansa has in mind. They want to, I believe, retire their Dash 400 747s and move into this 777 variant. I think that it'll be interesting to see how this compares with the A350 and the A380. I mean, I don't know where the sweet spot is going to turn out as far as jumbo or super jumbo airplanes. Maybe there's room for both sizes, but this is definitely an important commitment on the part of Boeing, and we'll be following it along.
Well, sure, and of course, Boeing hasn't made the 747-400 for, I don't know, 4 years or 5 years or something like that, and they only have the 747-8, which is, they didn't sell very many of those, from what I understand. So who knows what effect this may have on that as well. But again, I guess that happens when you have too many aircraft with overlap at places like this.
All right, well, let's press on to our next article. This comes from the Chicago Tribune. Suit claims United Airlines frequent flyer rewards are rigged. Now, I thought this was a fascinating story. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but apparently two people from New Jersey, not sure why that's important, but they're from New Jersey, are suing United. They had planned to take a trip to Japan, and they were going to use their frequent flyer miles to book a three-day hotel stay. But one of them, the guy who initially tried to do that, found out that he didn't have enough miles. So she had more miles and logged in right away within seconds to use her miles to book this hotel. But she found that the requirement for the number of miles increased. And that made them a little bit upset, and they filed a lawsuit.
So the policy is it always takes 1,000 miles more than you have to book the hotel? Is that the idea?
Well, United has been asked by several news outlets to sort of explain this, and they really haven't given a comprehensive answer other than to say that there's an algorithm. In other words, there's a computer someplace that's calculating the reward levels for different things, in this case, hotel rooms. And that calculation can depend on how many frequent flyer miles you have. So if you have more miles, they may charge you more for the same reward than they would charge somebody who had fewer miles. I don't think this is unusual in our industry. I think there's sort of some opportunistic application of frequent flyer miles, and same for airline tickets. The prices can change depending on the circumstances. That's hard to explain to a consumer, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm having a little heartburn with this one. I mean, if someone had said, and I've seen this happen, where you try to book a ticket on a Thursday night and you don't save it and you go back a day later or 2 days later and the price is another couple hundred dollars more, and that's I guess over the years I've gotten used to seeing that, so it doesn't surprise me too much. But in this particular case where someone that logs in with their United Mileage Plus account And they find out that the room in Tokyo is, you know, matter 10,000 points or whatever it is. But they only have 9,000. As Bill said, you're always a little short. And then someone else logs into the same place, the same day, same in and out times, and they find out that they're going to charge them even more. I'm having trouble with that one.
It's tough to swallow, huh?
Yeah, I think it really is. So, but this is going to be very interesting to see, because I think most people have always thought that the frequent flyer deals were pretty raw anyway. So I can't tell you how many times I wanted to kick the machine when I've tried to book something on using my American Airlines points. And, you know, I can get to Las Vegas or I can get to Los Angeles if I do Chicago, Seattle, Vegas, Los Angeles, and it takes, you know, 14 flying hours or something, but it's free. So I think there's a strong motivation to say, the heck with it, I'll just buy a ticket.
I think that the airlines are using some pretty sophisticated algorithms. I mean, they're trying to, well, in terms of airfare, trying to maximize their revenue. In terms of frequent flyer miles, I mean, the extent to which the people use up their miles, I guess, is good, because that lowers the liability. Like I say, I think the algorithms are fairly complicated and take into account a lot of different factors. This couple, and I don't know that for a fact that they are a couple per se, but I'll call them that. This couple is seeking class action status in this lawsuit. And we'll see if that goes anywhere. If it does, this could be very interesting. Maybe if United is smart, they'll just settle with these people and be done with it. Because otherwise, they're going to have to expose all the sort of internal logic and, you know, all that kind of stuff that they probably don't want to put out there in the public. Another messy situation.
If you say United has already admitted that part of the algorithm that was how many miles they have in their account.
Yes, yes.
That's like guilty right there, isn't it? I mean, if I go into the hardware store to buy a can of paint, he says, how much you got in your wallet?
That's right. That's exactly what it's like, huh?
The price should be set before they look in my wallet.
Yeah.
It seems that way. So I'll be curious to see what comes out of this.
Yeah, I want to see where this one ends up.
Yeah, this is going to be fun to watch. All right, speaking of fun, Mooney, we have from AvWeb, Mooney sold to the Chinese. So there's this Chinese real estate company, Meijing Group, and reportedly they plan to purchase Mooney with the intent of resuming production, according to this article, in China and in Asia. So we've been seeing a number of examples of where the Chinese have been getting involved in general aviation by purchasing or taking controlling interest in U.S. GA companies. And here we go again with Mooney.
A U.S. component going to be left at all?
It's really hard to say, Bill. And we have this other article at the same time in the Wichita Eagle from Molly McMillan, who's been a guest in the past on our podcast, who reports that Mooney Aviation is going to restart manufacturing of these airplanes in January, and they're getting funding from something called Soaring America Corporation that's based in California.
It looks like a U.S. scanning the article, it looks like a U.S. Operation. So
how do these two reconcile?
Well, the news follows reports this week from a Chinese news source that Meijing Group, a Chinese real estate developer registered in the provincial capital of Zhengzhou, was expected to buy Mooney. It's unclear what the relationship is. Ah!
Read the next paragraph.
Soaring America filed for incorporation in November 2012. It lists two young men who sound like they are from China as... But that doesn't tell you where they're from. It doesn't tell you whether they're Chinese citizens or U.S. citizens. So I think there's something we have to think about here.
Yeah, it's not entirely clear.
No.
As to who is purchasing, assuming someone is purchasing, we don't know. We don't know if it's a purchase of Mooney or an investment in Mooney. And we don't know if it is by a Chinese company or someone who is Chinese but maybe is not necessarily a Chinese corporation.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. Now, Mooney was at Oshkosh this past year, I understand, Rob. I don't know if you had a chance to see them.
I did not see them, no. I did not see them. So, I would have noticed.
I mean, that's sort of interesting in and of itself. You could ask yourself, well, why would Mooney be there with a, I guess, a relatively modest display or a booth?
Of old airplanes.
Of old airplanes, unless they had some ideas about what might be coming. I believe in the AvWeb article, they mentioned that Mooney told AvWeb that they were keeping all of their certifications current, which would suggest that, I guess, that if they were going to restart production, that they wouldn't have that hurdle to get through if they had all the certifications. So, but we just have lots of stories this week, Rob, where interesting things are going to happen that we're going to have to watch and find out what transpires.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that always bears watching in the sense of making sure we have all of our sources in a line here. And like I said, I didn't see this thing from Mali, though, until just a couple of seconds ago. But that certainly would make me wonder whether it is, again, just a person of Chinese ancestry that lives in the U.S. that is buying into this, or if it is a kind of a shadow organization for some other Chinese manufacturer. Of course, to me, I would be thinking they've been very upfront. They tried to buy Hawker Beechcraft. They bought Cirrus. I can't imagine any reason they'd necessarily want to try to hide anything they were doing. There's nothing wrong with what they're doing, but I think we're going to have to let this one play out a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Well, it'd be nice if Mooney can resume production in whatever form that's going to take. Have you flown Moonies before, Rob? You must have.
Yeah, years ago. Not for a long time, but they were nice, compact, fast airplanes, fairly efficient. I mean, most of the Moonies came with 200 horsepower engines, and they'd easily fly at, I don't know, Bill, maybe you instructed in one, I don't know what, 170, 180 knots or something. But they were always really sprightly little machines.
Yeah, they were. I flew them in college, actually, in the late 70s, and enjoyed them quite a bit then, a little bit afterward. I think they were 200 mile an hour plus airplanes, if I recall. So,
in college, Bill, you started your flying interest at a pretty young age, if I recall.
Yeah, I actually took lessons when I was 15 and a half, and soloed when I was 16, and got my license 2 days after my 17th birthday, before I had my driver's license.
Wow. Were either of your parents pilots or in aviation, or is this something that you sort of
My father almost got his private license, but he did not complete it.
So was he pretty supportive in terms of you learning to fly?
Oh, yeah, very much.
Yeah. Good. All right, next item comes from the New York Times. Airlines cash in on every inch, even the jammed bins overhead. So there was kind of an interesting quote in this article that I kind of liked. It says, "The battle of the bins, that pre-flight scrum over precious carry-on space, has turned into something else for airlines, the business of the bins." And so what this article is talking about, I think, is that overhead bin space is fairly coveted by passengers, especially as there are charges oftentimes for checked luggage, and people like the convenience of stashing their stuff in the overhead bin. And there are ways that the airlines can capitalize on that demand in terms of boarding sequence based on things like the class of your ticket, or whether you've used a credit card, an airline credit card, to purchase your flight, and that this is another potential revenue source. Bill, do you guys just like sit up in the front and kind of just chuckle as people are in the back trying to find a place to put their stuff overhead?
We're pretty busy at the time. No time to look back and laugh at anybody. Sorry.
Okay.
That's why they have the door. Because they want you to be focused on what you're doing and not watching all the people coming in and out, right?
Absolutely right. That's the reason for the door.
Yeah, sure.
And they don't want to be bothered by geeky people saying, "Oh, look, can I come in and see how it all works?"
We're always glad to give a tour, actually. Always glad to give a tour.
Well, sometimes this is cause for some agitation amongst the passengers. I mean, I think we've all seen examples where tempers flare, people get a little bit hot under the collar because someone has, quote, taken their space or is using too much space in the overhead bins. It can oftentimes be a struggle. I know I hate it when I get on an airplane. It's like, oh God, am I going to walk down the aisle and find that the overhead bins are full and there's no place to put my bag? It's always a problem, it seems.
I think that another factor may be that not all bins are the same size. So some airplanes, their bins are fairly generous size and everybody can get their stuff in. On others, especially the ones that are a little bit older, and assume people check their bags without being charged $50 to do so,
yeah,
you know, they fill up pretty quickly and they're really not that big to begin with. So sometimes a bag, for example, can't fit in straight in. You have to put it in sideways, which of course takes the place of two other people's bags at the same time.
So it's an interesting story. You can check the show notes for the link to it. I think that, you know, I've said in the past that fees are sort of the crack cocaine of the airline industry. And with carriers bringing in just huge amounts of revenue for various fees in the recent past, there's really no motivation for them to do other than keep looking for new ways to do that. And overhead bin space is maybe the latest frontier for fees and using different mechanisms.
I think there's another way to another perspective, which I'm sure the management folks would tell you, is that without the fees, they may not be making any money at all.
Oh, for sure. Yes.
You know, so the fees allow folks to pay only for the services that they use. So if they don't check a bag, they don't have to pay for you know, the average person's check bag. If they don't buy a meal, they don't have to pay for the average person's otherwise airline-provided meal, et cetera.
Right.
So,
no, Bill, I think you're right. I mean, if the airlines hadn't come across this idea, they would be so far in the red right now that a lot of them would probably be in some significant financial difficulty. As everyone knows, the airline business has never been a high-margin kind of business. And it's some years there's profits and many years there's not. But the billions that the fees have brought in have, I think, at least tended to keep the airlines in the black a little bit in the recent past. And that's a good thing, right? Everybody has to make money. We want them to be successful and stay in business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
Are you unconvinced, Rob?
Well, no, I think something that always drives me a little crazy are the people that bring things that look like the back end of their car down the aisle.
Oh, yeah.
And I've always wondered how they get them in the airplane. You see those little, and Bill, I'm sure you've seen those little cages they usually have by the gate somewhere that says, if your bag fits in here, it'll fit in the overhead compartment. And I've watched people bring stuff that no way in the world would ever fit in that case, and they still get them on. So
I think those are mostly for fit under your seat check, actually. But yeah, I see people bring. They'd bring refrigerators if you let them.
I'm sure some have tried.
Probably right.
All right. Well, one last item in the news segment here. Just wanted to mention that astronaut Scott Carpenter died the other day at age 88. This is from complications following a stroke that he had had. Scott Carpenter, of course, was one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. He was a U.S. Navy reconnaissance pilot during the Korean War. And so we've lost another one of the sort of pioneers. Rob, I'm sure, and maybe you as well, Bill, but Rob, certainly, you remember those days, those early days of manned spaceflight.
Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't realize that he'd passed away. Of course, I hadn't been watching the news, but apparently I completely missed this. But I believe, this is why we need David. I'm trying to think of how many of the original Mercury 7 guys are left. I mean, I know John Glenn is, but I don't know if there are others. Maybe our listeners can tell us since David's not here.
Yeah, because I think you're right, Rob. I think we have lost quite a few of them.
Did you ever want to be an astronaut, Bill?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was my main inspiration as a child for got me into aviation when kind of figured out that the astronaut thing was a little bit less likely to achieve than the airline pilot thing.
You know, I had a chance when we were in Wichita week four last. I had a chance to reconnect with Gene Cernan, who was the Apollo 17 commander, and So Gene Cernan tells this story about getting ready to go to the moon, and he's out on the front lawn with his wife and his daughter, and I think she's maybe 9 or 10 years old or something like that. And he said, you know, honey, Daddy's going to be up there tomorrow. And he's pointing this big, bright, full moon. And she said, oh, does that mean you're not taking me camping? That was about as interested as she was. He said she got better over the years, but at age 10, that was about all she cared about.
That's a great story.
Well, just doing a quick check on the original Mercury 7 astronauts. It looks like John Glenn is the only surviving member of the original 7.
Wow, that's something else.
Boy, and when you see that first Mercury capsule, it was a chair with metal around it. I mean, you couldn't do anything in. I mean, they did essentially pack them in there and lock them in, and
yeah, put them on the top of an ICBM, and yeah, off you go.
There's an interesting fact that I came across the other day that I had remembered from an earlier time that they had originally, the engineers had originally wanted those to be completely remotely controlled or automatically controlled, and the astronauts fought to retain a window or to gain a window and manual control. And manual control came in handy on John Glenn's flight.
Yeah, and a couple others as well. Yeah, that's there are some interesting stories from back then. I know also that at one point when they were sort of plotting out the strategy to that culminated with man on the moon, that they were actually considering seriously a mission where the astronauts would not be coming back. In other words, we'd go to the moon, they'd be on the moon, we'd be able to say we were on the moon, and that's as far as the mission would go. I'm glad they changed that strategy.
Well, somebody's proposing a Mars mission like that now, too. I think it was a private company. They had a long list of volunteers.
All right. Rob, you want to lead us on a conversation about Air France 447?
Well, I think we need to make sure that everybody that's listening, but we should tell them a little bit about Bill, who is a captain on the A330 for one of the major airlines here in the States. And he was involved in the development team for the introduction of that airplane to the fleet back in 2002. And Bill really, I think one of the things that really helped Bill save me at Jetwine, not to mention write this book, was that he was the lead author and editor for the for that airline's A330 systems manuals, and he's written a number of training publications. He's been a simulator instructor, a check airman, a designated examiner, and you know, he's been around the airline world for a while. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, he started flying at 15. I thought I was doing pretty well at 17, but you know, that's another story. And I think this is, Bill, you know, I never knew this until, I don't know how long, not that long ago, that you had a BS in aeronautical science from Embry-Riddle, which helped you really understand a lot of what was going on. And I think that has, I guess maybe one thing I'm curious about, do you think that all of the training that you've done over the years just made you generally a curious person to start with when it came to something like the Air France accident?
Probably, and you know, just kind of a curious guy to how do things work, how I'm wired, I suppose. So, you know, I wanted to understand what happened, and also to make sure that the other pilots understood what happened and why and what to do about it and what all this meant.
I wondered if maybe you could take us back about 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, to that early morning of June the 1st, 2009, and maybe just give our listeners who may not know all the facts about what happened, just kind of a factual description of what occurred that night aboard this airplane.
Sure. Well, it was an Airbus A330 left Rio de Janeiro en route to Paris, France. The crew had a three-day layover in Rio. And apparently had quite a fun time. And so by the time they were ready to fly, they were already tired. So they had climbed to 35,000 feet. They were north of just north of the coast of Brazil over the South Atlantic Ocean. And they were flying into the intertropical convergence zone, which is an area of weather that surrounds the planet in that time of year, just a little bit north of the equator. and it has thunderstorms that can develop to very high elevations or very high altitudes. And those type of storms in that area don't tend to show up on radar very well, which is one of the lessons of it. So anyway, they flew basically into the thunderstorm, did not make much effort to go around it or to deviate from the more intense parts of it, and encountered an updraft that, whether it was icing or rain or whatever, clogged the pitot tubes, which, of course, help the airplane measure the airspeed that it's flying. So the airspeed sensors were no longer able to record the correct airspeed, which made the automation that was depending on that information turn off. So the autopilot turned off, the autothrust turned off, and the flight directors, for the most part, turned off as well. So this handed the airplane back to the pilots unexpectedly, you know, in the middle of the night. It's dark out, they're in the clouds, it's bumpy, they're in the middle of a thunderstorm. The pilot in the right seat was the pilot in command. He was one of two first officers. The captain had just taken his rest break about 10 minutes earlier. He resumed control and immediately had a little bit of a trouble getting the roll under control. And in that process, pitched up the airplane and started to climb at times up to over 6,000 feet per minute. Obviously, they were already near their limit altitude, so they didn't have a lot of extra energy to make a climb of that kind. They ended up near about 38,000 feet, so they climbed just under 3,000 feet in the climb and lost about 90 to 100 knots in the process of that. So the two pilots were trying to get the airplane under control, but of course they had lost a lot of airspeed and apparently tried to just level off at 38,000 feet without trying to stop the climb, but the airplane is unable to maintain that altitude and the airplane continued to lose airspeed. And as it did, of course, as you might expect, it eventually got into a stall situation. The stall warning was on for over 50 seconds in a row at one point. And I believe, contrary to what a lot will say, that they didn't do anything to recover from the stall. They applied full power to recover from the stall, which is quite effective at 5,000 feet. And in fact, how they were trained to recover from a stall when they did their A320 checkout several years earlier on. They checked out on the A320 and then moved to the A330. But at 38,000 feet, adding full power doesn't do anything because you're already pretty much at full power anyway. So the airplane continued to stall and began to descend, descend quite rapidly. Even though the stall warning was going on repeatedly, they did not push the nose down to recover from the stall by reducing the angle of attack in that manner. In fact, as the airplane fell, they pulled the nose up to try to prevent the airplane from falling more, which exacerbated the problem. The airplane ended up descending at 10 to 20,000 feet per minute with angles of attack between 30 and 60 degrees, and they fell from 38,000 feet to the water in just a little over 3.5 minutes.
Bill, what would that feel like as a passenger, let's say? Would you feel the extreme angle of attack, and would you feel the descent of the plane?
Well, remember, the angle of attack is not the pitch attitude of the airplane. The pitch attitude was never one that was considered an unusual attitude even. The nose had pitched up the maximum, I believe, was about 16 degrees. Most of the time, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 12, you know, varying quite a bit. So the angle of attack is just the angle of the wind to the wing. And so that's not something that you can feel or sense.
Okay.
Now, once the stall started, the airplane did start to buffet quite enough that on the voice recorder, they can hear things rattling in the airplane and know that it is shaking quite a bit. And, of course, that vibration is recorded on the flight recorders as well. The captain, who was back in the rest area, or actually back in the cabin most likely, because he had just left the cockpit about 10 minutes earlier to begin his rest period, I believe, and most people believe, that he came back on his own just from the feel of the airplane, because as the airplane pitched up for that climb, they pulled about 1.6 Gs at one point in the climb. So it's quite a significant G load, and of course you probably could feel the rocking back and forth and everything. So when he came up to the flight deck, even though they had been calling the crew rest area to try to bring him back, he didn't say, what do you want, as if they had been calling him, but he said, what are you doing? He came back on his own, you know, to say, what's going on up here? You know, giving us a heck of a ride back there. Hmm. And by that time, they had said, well, we don't know what's happening. We lost control of the airplane. When they when he came back up, the airplane was now falling back through the original altitude where he left at 35,000 feet. And the pitch was up and the power was up. The airspeed indications were now, they're very low or possibly invalid, depending on at what point he looked at them. So it probably presented quite a confusing picture, not knowing or not realizing that they had climbed, in fact, 3,000 feet and fallen in those 3,000 feet during the time that he was gone. And so, in fact, at one point he remarked on the recorder that it was impossible. So obviously he had some trouble trying to figure out what exactly the situation was and which instruments were correct and which were not.
Bill, something I'm always interested in is that we've talked on many occasions about the number of warning signals and messages, both visually and orally, that were going off. And this is not the kind of thing, or this kind of scenario was not something these pilots were ever trained for, was it?
No. The training did not include, and in fact, for any airline that I'm aware of, stall recovery at high altitude. Didn't really probably come over or cover handling of the airplane in the degraded flight control law at high altitude. Even though it's not significantly different than normal, there are some aspects of it which do kind of complicate things. And so, I mean, I think that these guys were probably mostly focused on flying the airplane with the autopilot on and following the flight director pretty much 100% of the time. And when you're tired and you have to fly the airplane when you weren't expecting to fly the airplane, the alarms are going off, don't really know what's happening, that there's what the final report was called the startle effect, which, it's aptly named. You know, you're not expecting this to happen. All of a sudden, bam, you know, here you are. And, you know, it's obviously you're not – few people will be prepared to take something that they're totally unprepared to do.
But, of course, something we did talk about a couple of weeks ago, too, is that I believe there were other incidents on A330s within, say, a few months prior to this Air France issue. Were there not?
Yes, there were. There were some starting about a year before – a year to 6 months before, and some afterward. It was a phenomena that had occurred mostly in the tropical latitudes in these kinds of storms that have areas where, according to the pitot tube certification standards, it was assumed that everything was frozen at that altitude, and you wouldn't be getting this kind of blocking and precipitation. You know, so there were certain types of updrafts within these storms that presented problems, which, frankly, they didn't really know enough about to design the pitot standards to guard against, apparently.
I guess it was maybe some 2 years before they discovered the wreckage and the black boxes and so forth. What was the effect of that? I mean, did it just delay what would have happened otherwise by the 2 years or whatever it was? Or is there some other effect on the investigation that's caused by this sort of gap in time where we were able to kind of do almost no investigating?
Well, the wreckage was in 12,000 feet of water,
yeah.
So which made it very, very difficult. The flight recorder's underwater beacon, which is supposed to send out a signal, you know, to help you locate it, was damaged in the wreckage. But it was so deep that even if they had dragged the sensor directly over top of the wreckage, they wouldn't have been able to hear it. It was extremely rugged area. It was described as looking for a mailbox in New York City to try to find the flight recorders in the mountainous area. Fortunately, it ended up on a flat area in that zone, and they were able to locate it, you know, after about four searches with all kinds of sophisticated radar and remotely operated vehicles and such. So it was quite an extensive search. It cost many millions of dollars to do that, and they desperately needed to find it because needed to know what the cause was. Everybody was, you know, people were blaming Airbus, or was it the pilots, or was it, you know, what happened? We knew an A330 flew into a thunderstorm and disappeared. There were some messages that were sent from the maintenance computer during the event, from the time that the autopilot clicked off until it hit the water. But those messages are not always easy to interpret. The first reason is because more than one thing can cause the message. And the second is because they're only timestamped to within 1 minute. So we had a number of them all occur within the same minute. And we don't really know for sure which one happened first. Mm. And so there may be multiple ways to put those puzzle pieces together.
Interesting.
And so it's not like it's downloading the flight recorder. It's just those messages were designed to help maintenance prepare for themselves for when the airplane arrived at its destination and they knew what to fix or what to check or what to replace or look for. They weren't designed to be part of an accident investigation. And some of the messages themselves, you know, many will require a verification period. So let's say an event happens where something appears to fail. The computer will say, well, we'll check on that in a few seconds, maybe 10 or 30 seconds later. And if it's failed, then we'll register the event. So the absence of messages doesn't necessarily mean that something didn't fail because it could be within that verification period. And there in fact, was one of those items as well. Right. And then you have messages, for example, there was a cabin altitude warning, a cabin rate warning. And, well, you know, some people had theorized initially that the tail broke off in flight. There it is lying on the top of the water. And the other wreckage is floating over here. Well, that must be what happened. And, well, there you go. The airplane broke up, and that's the pressure issue. Mm. Well, in fact, it turns out that wasn't the case at all because it took 5 days to find any of the wreckage. And, you know, it's exposed to the currents of the ocean for 5 days, and the fact that one part drifts different than another should be no surprise. Mm. Now, you know, if it had been on land and the tail fell here and everything else fell 10 miles apart, that'd be a different story, of course. But when it's on the water, that's not quite the same.
It really is a big jigsaw puzzle kind of a situation, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. And without the flight recorders, you know, it would have been difficult to say for sure exactly what happened.
Something I wondered about, Bill, is that we talked earlier about those other flights, those other A330s that had run into similar situations in similar parts of the world. Why do you think those pilots were able to recover the airplane while these pilots were not?
They may have, frankly, been better pilots, more experience in hand flying the airplane. They may have not been tired, not as startled. It's hard to say what all the factors were, but one of the subjects that comes out of this accident is the aspect of automation addiction, because we see for several studies that pilots' skills at hand flying the airplane, especially on instruments, like any skill, like playing the piano or playing basketball, degrade with non-use. Another aspect of it is, you know, a lot of the European carriers, you don't have 5,000 hours when you're hired by the airline. You have very few, and then they send you to training. And so you're quite actually inexperienced when you first get into an airliner. And so the most of his career, and many career pilots' careers around the world, is sitting there with the autopilot on and following the flight director and doing these procedures and not really getting a lot of stick time, especially if you're what's often referred to as a cruise pilot, where you get very little stick time for takeoff and landing. Your job is mostly to be flying the airplane in cruise to give rest breaks to the other pilots, and you keep current in the simulator. So all these factors kind of add up and make us be aware that we still have to have real pilots in the airplane when this stuff happens, because you never know what's going to happen. And it's good to practice. And it's good to practice with the automation off. I often have my first officers fly with the flight director off. And, you know, they may be surprised that, wow, this is a little harder than I thought. Because they may be often, most everybody flies with the flight director on, the autopilot off, and they think they're really hand flying. But, you know, that flight director does about 75% of the brain work, the mental work for you when you're flying on instruments, even if it's a nice clear blue day. So, you know, those scan skills, they go away if you don't use them. And if you never had them very well to begin with, it gets even harder when you're presented with this type of situation, you know, unexpectedly, in the dark.
So in that regard, Bill, have we seen some changes in training or in maintaining proficiency?
Yeah, we have. In fact, the FAA actually put out a notice for operators that says, hey, guys, we would encourage the maintaining of proficiency with hand flying the airplane. And we've seen, I've seen the simulator that as well that, you know, the hand flying the airplane, the visual approaches is often the toughest part. You know, we saw with the Asiana 214 accident, you know, that was a visual approach. And there's been many reports that that the Korean pilots in particular didn't like visual approaches. You know, that required, you know, it wasn't a step-by-step procedure that you could just do it by the cookbook. Mm.
You know, I guess what I'm wondering, too, is that if hand-flying the airplane is the solution, or giving people better training at what an airplane flies like up high, just so they'll know. I mean, is it just a matter of telling the simulators that they use to go up to 370 and now we'll practice some stalls and then you'll know exactly what it's like?
Oh, that's certainly a big part of it. And it's, you know, to recover from a stall 5,000 feet where we, for years and years we had trained like that, you throw the power to it, and the emphasis was on minimal loss of altitude. Well, at 38,000 feet, that just doesn't work. Well,
tell us why. Just, you know, give us a
there's
few.
There's no additional power. You have to push down to reduce the angle of attack and get back your airspeed by trading altitude for it. There's just no other way to do it. And, of course, you know, when you get basically on the backside of the power curve, with the little additional power you have, it's literally impossible to accelerate under those conditions, you know, unless you're flying a rocket, which we don't.
Well, if I remember correctly, I think you mentioned this in your book, or maybe it was during one of our conversations, although I'm sure it was in the book. You mentioned that once they had, even if they had noticed specifically what was going on and tried to get the nose down at some point, it could have taken them many, many, many thousands of feet to get the airplane back flying again. Is that correct?
Yeah, so it depends. And that's, you know, when you read the article in the magazine, most of them concentrate on what happened in the last 3.5 minutes while in this really extreme descent when the airplane was fully stalled. And, of course, by that time, it's almost too late. The real lessons occur in the first minute where control was lost. So, you know, that's where they didn't know what pitch attitude to go to recover to level flight, apparently, and climb 3,000 feet. And lost, you know, airspeed and didn't know how to recover from a stall strictly with pitch. The farther they went along, the more extreme measures had to be taken to recover. So initially, all they had to do was know that they had to go to about 3 degrees of pitch. And that's what these other flights that you have heard about that aren't famous have done. They maintained the cruise pitch attitude, and within a minute, the airspeeds came back, and they went on their merry way. As the airplane climbed, of course, it has less energy. Now they're going to have to decrease the pitch and make a descent, probably back to their original altitude, maybe a little bit lower to gain the airspeed back and resume. And, of course, once the airplane got into the stall situation, now it gets even harder. A complicating factor on this is once their very steep descent had begun and they're trying to pull back on the stick to arrest the descent and get things to go, the pitch trim, which is automatic on the Airbus aircraft, especially the A330, ran to full nose up. Well, my experiments in the simulator, which granted are not certified for this part of the envelope because it's not flight tested. We don't actually know from flight testing what it's like to extremely stall the airplane and let it fall down at 10,000 feet per minute. But anyway, my testing in the simulator has showed that to regain control, you have to push the nose down and hold it down, and you will have to manually reduce that nose-up trim to get it to a point where you have enough elevator control to resume a normal flight. And that is probably asking too much of the crew to think of that at that time. The stab trim in the Airbus fly-by-wire aircraft is totally automatic, so it is pretty far from your thought pattern. There's no indication directly in front of you of what the trim is. It runs quietly and pretty much out of the scene. So it's easy to understand why they didn't recognize that the stab trim had run full nose up, because virtually no indication that it has. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, the A350 does have the stab trim setting on the primary flight display, or directly in front of the pilot on one of the displays anyway. So learn a little bit from everything.
Do you think it's because of this accident that they put that in?
I don't know. I don't know how long it's been in the design, so I can't say.
Well, Bill, why don't you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about the book you've written and where they can order it?
It's available as an ebook and a paperback. You can buy the ebook on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, and on iTunes for the iBook readers on Apple devices. You can also get the paperback on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or if you'd like a signed version, you can get it on the book's companion website, which is understandingaf447.com.
Very good. Is this the first book you've written?
This is the first book I've written with my name on it.
Oh. Is that because you didn't want anybody to know? No.
I've written actually several, or been the lead author and editor on several aircraft systems manual for my airline.
Oh, yes, of course.
DC-10, A330, and worked on a 787 one as well. And written numerous training articles and produced videos and stuff. But those are company publications, so they don't have authors' names on it. So this is my first public solo debut.
And Rob Mark wrote the foreword for your book, didn't he?
He did. He was very nice about
it. Did you ask him, or did he beg you?
I asked him. Okay.
I have to admit, when Bill asked me about that, I was kind of taken aback. I thought, wow, this is because for writers, that's a big deal. I mean, you only find people that you have a fair amount of respect for to do the forewords. And so I was very honored to have been chosen for that. I really want to make sure that people know that all of us that fly are supposed to be humble enough to realize that we never know it all. And I have to tell you, I'd learned so much about how airplanes fly or don't fly, as well as how the A330 systems operated and may have come together in a really bad form that night for these poor guys. And so I think it's going to be a book that's very, very hard to put down.
And this is also an indicator of why it's important that accident investigations be pure, in that they represent a learning experience for everyone, so that we don't repeat these kinds of things in the future, as opposed to sometimes we see investigations which have, they can have heavy political or other overtones over them. Do you guys feel that this particular investigation was pretty free of that stuff, and that it was a nice, clean investigation?
For the most part, the BEA, which is the French investigative agency, does not release the full transcript of the voice recorder. They edit out things that they feel are not relevant. Apparently, one of the things that they've edited out was the captain admitting that he only had an hour of sleep ahead of time. This is coming out in the civil trials at this point. So I think that if we look at the NTSB reports, they put it all out there, and you can decide whether the pilot's talking about the baseball game is relevant or not. I think an admission that I only had an hour of sleep last night would be pretty relevant to me.
Yes.
So they tried to – they didn't go into what the pilots were doing on their layover or some other things, as, citing privacy concerns and that it was none of their business and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, they take a little bit of a slant on it. But I think for the most part, it was a genuine effort to find out what happened and why. And they did a pretty good job on it. It wasn't some people will say it's political, that, they didn't say this or they didn't say that. Part of the reason I wrote my book was to explain a lot of what this means, because, they talk about certain things that if someone was to pick up the accident report, doesn't necessarily put it in context or even in the right chronological order. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the things, if I can make one more point about the A330, which is a fantastic airplane. It's a very safe airplane. And that night when they lost the airspeeds, even though the airplane is not normally supposed to stall, and that is correct, those protections that are normally in place were lost due to the loss of airspeed and the subsequent situation that they got into. So, in those situations, the pilots are trained that, okay, you've lost your protections, you have to be careful. And, you know, that is one of the great lessons, is in this situation, when you're in this alternate flight control law, what's the airplane doing? What protections do you have? And you need to be aware of that. It's not something you can just, you know, memorize for the test and go on. It's something you need to be cognizant of.
All right. Very good. Bill Palmer, thank you so much for coming on the show. The book is Understanding AF447, and we encourage all of our listeners to go find that and give it a read.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
Appreciate
this was really, really enlightening, and I hope our listeners enjoyed it as well. So, and we'll probably hear from a few of them, and we'll get back to you with that.
Oh, good. I often blog about related subjects on my blog, which is a Trend Vector. It's at trendvector.blogspot.com. And of course, they can comment on that as well. And there's a link to buy the book there also.
Okay, great. And now with his Aircraft of the Week, here's David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Okay, folks, I'll be honest. I'm recording this on Tuesday night after a almost 12-hour drive back from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. So I was a bit exhausted last night, and I needed the break. So it's Tuesday night. I'm done with turkey until American Thanksgiving. And I would like to thank Ray Williams for submitting this subject, Aircraft of the Week. I'm kind of partial to it. I helped restore one once, and I have flown in one. So I was very happy to see this come up, because I don't think I could have done a better job on it. So this week's Airplane of the Week actually is the Vickers Viscount airliner. So again, thanks to Ray for doing this and giving me a week off from not doing research. So let's begin. Throughout the Second World War, transport aircraft development had continued in the United States, resulting in the workhorse DC-4 and the sleek Constellation. Large aircraft production in Britain, however, was primarily focused on bombers. With this in mind, the Brabazon Committee was formed in 1942 to study the advances in aviation technology and to ensure the British aircraft manufacturers would not be left behind and could use these advances to supply the needs of air travel within the British Commonwealth and Empire after the war. The committee initially set out requirements for four distinct types, the second category being a short-haul airliner to replace the Douglas DC-3 and the Dragon Rapide on European and similar routes elsewhere. It was the second Brabazon Committee, sitting in 1945, who had to determine how these requirements were to be implemented. For the Type 2 aircraft, they determined that the most promising design would incorporate four gas turbine engines driving air screws. Yet turboprops were a new concept, and the committee hedged their bet by splitting the Type 2 into Type 2A, a 24-seater twin piston engine airliner, and Type 2B, the larger turboprop. Vickers Armstrong had been watching the development of the Brabazon Committee's reports. Their current twin-engine passenger aircraft, the Viking, developed from the Wellington bomber, had been reviewed as an interim design from the start. The proposed successor, a twin turbojet, morphed as they studied the requirements into a turboprop airliner. Thus, when the committee's requirements for the Type 2B crystallized, Vickers was in a relatively strong position, and in June 1945, they submitted their VC-2 proposal. It would carry a 7,500-pound payload over 1,040 statute miles, flying at 20,000 feet at a speed of 297 miles per hour. The fuselage was to be a double-bubble design seating 27 passengers. However, there was some doubt within Vickers about the concept and with the need for pressurization dictated by the turboprop's economical altitude of 20,000 feet, a circular fuselage section of 10 feet 8 inches external diameter was settled on with four-breast seating. By the time the contract was placed, and after a consultation with BEA, who was viewed as their first customer, Vickers had determined they could lengthen the fuselage by 9 feet to 74 feet 6 inches, and with a corresponding increase in wingspan to 89 feet, increase the payload to 32 passengers. This VC-2 was now given the type number V609 and named Viceroy. The aircraft had been designed to take either the Armstrong Siddeley Mamba or the Rolls-Royce Dart engines, with both prototypes scheduled to have the Mambas. However, in August 1947, the Dart had been fundamentally improved and the decision was to proceed with them as the power plants. This changeover meant a new type number. It became the V630. At the same time, the independence of India meant the position of Viceroy no longer existed and the aircraft's name was changed to Viscount. As a side note, folks, growing up, I used to say it was the Viscount. The prototype V630 Gulf Alpha Hotel Romeo Foxtrot was rolled out at Wisley in June 1948 and made its first flight on 16 July. These flights whetted the airline's appetites for turboprop aircraft, and this increased when Rolls-Royce came out with the enhanced Dart engine with a 40% increase in shaft horsepower of 1,400. These engines, BEA's desire to stretch the V630 was possible, and in February 1949, the ministry gave Vickers a contract for one V700. Vickers had, on its own and without a government contract, been building the third prototype V630, and by using this, were able to bring out the prototype V700 in a mere 18 months. The V700 differed from the V630 by having a 5 foot greater wingspan and an 80 inch longer fuselage. It could seat 53 passengers and cruising speed rode from 275 miles an hour to 310. Meanwhile, Gulf Alpha Hotel Romeo Foxtrot had completed its proving flights and with the flying colors, and on 29th July 1950 flew the world's first scheduled turboprop flight from London to Paris. Passengers liked the quieter and vibrationless environment the turboprops offered, as well as the superb visibility of the large oval windows, a design which provided fewer stress concentrations on the fuselage, as well being the minimum size for emergency exits. BEA produced an order for 20 V701s, a slightly modified version with an accommodation for 47 passengers in a five-breast layout, with engines moved outboard by 18 engines to reduce propeller noise and vibration in the cabin. Orders then came from Air France, Trans-Australia, and Aer Lingus. In 1951, two other aircraft were catching the attention of European pilots. A couple of Dakotas were cruising at 25,000 feet at over 200 miles an hour. The certification of the piston engine aircraft had generally not presented an issue, as motors were most often used in military aircraft and much data on their reliability and operation had already been known. For the turboprops, these were not available, and so two BEA Dakota freighters were converted to take the Dart 505 engines and sent out on regular freight schedules where they put in nearly 2,000 hours of testing. In November 1952, Vickers got a big win. TransCanada Airlines, having been given a very vigorous wooed by the U.S. government industry, their traditional suppliers ordered 15 Viscounts. To get this, Vickers agreed to a major reworking design, including the North American equipment that was standard in the TCA fleet. In addition, the V700 prototype, Gulf Romeo Fox, spent 2 months in Hudson Bay to do severe winter testing. In 1953, Romeo Fox completed the London to New Zealand air race. According to the fastest time in transport category, the handicap, which was based on weight, brought it into second place behind the DC-6. In 1954, bought an order for 40 Viscounts for Capital Airlines, a record that lasted for many years as the largest single order for a turbine aircraft. Other U.S. airlines that operated the Viscount would be Aloha, Hawaiian, Continental, and the dreaded United. No, he didn't write that, folks. I just put that in for Rob. And in 1952, Rolls-Royce had announced the development of the 1960 Empire horsepower Dart, and this enabled the Vickers to start designing a larger Viscount, the V-800. This before the V-700 even entered airline service. But within a year of this decision, discussions between Vickers and BEA had determined that the new aircraft might be too large and the specs were changed for the V-802. Although not as long as the V-800, by moving the aft pressure bulkhead back 5 feet gave a passenger capacity of 71. As well as BEA, early models of the V-802 went to KLM, Aer Lingus, and NZNAC of New Zealand. Other airlines liked the capacity of the V-800 series but wanted better range, and thus the V-810 was developed and first flew in December 1957. With the new darts and their 21 Empire horsepower, the V-810 had a maximum takeoff weight of 72,500 pounds and a range of 1,750 miles. Some 57 airlines, a total of 442 Viscounts, were built. The last one built, delivered to CAAC of China in April 1964. Again, I'd like to thank Ray for giving us this great history of the Viscount and an airplane I'm kind of fond of after spending several hours polishing both the kitchen as well as the bathroom. And I'll have the pictures posted in the show notes. So again, thank you very much, Ray. And until next week, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 14th, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 270. And I'll tell you what, Grant, a pretty quiet week this week after all our press junkets last week.
Yeah, a little bit quiet, but we did... You know, we may not have been running around the country too much, but we did get to go and stand out on the tarmac.
We certainly did, out at the Qantas Maintenance Centre. And in fact, Grant, for the first time ever, I got to actually put my feet on the tarmac at Melbourne Airport. Well, you know, away from the arrivals area at Tiger Airways, at least.
Yeah, you're on the tarmac at Melbourne Airport, and you weren't going between aircraft and terminal.
It was fantastic. In fact, I was standing right out in front of the main, I guess it was the domestic terminal there, watching the Jetstar 787 arrive, and you were right down there on the runway. I tell you what, mate, that was a hard choice when we had to split up, but we had to cover both sides of the arrival, the landing, and the water salute.
That's right, mate. It was a bit of a decision who would take what, but I think you went with the water salute because it was being done by the ARFIs, the airport firefighter.
That was very impressive, mate. I'll tell you what, it was an extremely windy day out there in Melbourne last Wednesday when the aircraft arrived, and although those water cannons were quite a long way away doing the salute, the water was almost being blown vertically straight at us. It was actually kind of like being back in the fire brigade again. It was kind of cool, actually.
There you go. From my vantage point, I got some video of the water cannon salute, and yeah, it was definitely being blown back towards the terminal by that very strong northerly. Normally they would have probably arched over the top and got the aircraft, but hey, you know, they came close.
Absolutely. Well, Grant, I'll tell you what, we spent a great day out there at Melbourne Airport. We were out there most of the day, actually. It was one of the longest press junkets we've been to, and you know, they even made Jetstar 787 cupcakes, which I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, Diet Schmidt, you were ripping into those.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll have to go back on that diet again. Oh, good Lord. Well, I'll tell you what, Grant, Victor Kilo Alpha, the 787 that we've been talking about for weeks, we've followed it as it's come out of the paint shop there over there in Seattle, and of course it made its way across the Pacific, stopped in Honolulu on the way, and then completed its 13,000 plus kilometre trip direct here to Melbourne, and arrived to a huge welcome here at Melbourne. And of course Melbourne has been announced, as we talked about a few weeks ago, as the Australian home of the 787 fleet for Jetstar. And Grant, we got a great interview with one of the Jetstar bosses.
David Hall, welcome to Plane Crazy Down Under.
Thank you very much.
Hey, you're the CEO of Jetstar for Australia and New Zealand.
Yes, yeah.
And I imagine you've been quite involved in getting the 787 up and running.
Yeah, we're really, really excited to see it here today. The reality is now real. The dream is now reality. It's coming on to the air operator certificate for the Australian and New Zealand business. So we're just working through the final regulatory processes around all of that, and we hope to have it into service operating up and down the eastern seaboard very soon before we launch from Melbourne to Denpasar come mid-December. So,
can you tell us a bit about that certification process? It's obviously been a long road, this being first of type.
And we know some Dreamliners have had a few issues, for example, with batteries overseas. How has CASA been about that sort of
issue? Look, we've worked very well with CASA. We've got a great relationship with the regulator. They need to do what they do, and we certainly respect what they do. We've had a large team, an entry into service team, working for many, many months, well over a year now, as it sort of stop-start over the time, and worked very closely with CASA to ensure that we are compliant, we're regulatory, alignment with everything we need to do to ensure it's inducted safely into the fleet and it is very compliant. Safety and compliance leadership are number one priorities for Jetstar, and it's a strong collaborative relationship with CASA. They keep us honest, they keep us on our toes, and that's really good, and that's very important that as the regulator that they are happy, and we would only be happy when they're happy and that they've put us through our paces to ensure the safe passage of our crew and our customers.
Excellent. Now, at first it looked like Qantas was going to lead with a 787 and Jetstar would adopt as well. Now it's Jetstar leading. Qantas haven't really got it. I understand they've put their whole 787 prep on hold for the moment. So you've had to pick up all the burden. You've had to establish the training patterns. Have you established a simulator here?
Look, it's certainly not been a burden. It's been an absolute pleasure to do. It was always planned that the 8 Series would come into Jetstar and that they may eventually move back into Qantas. The 8s are staying in Jetstar now. Qantas have a large number of options and purchase rights on further Dreamliners. We were back when the board approved the business case for Jetstar International back in 2005-2006. It was always that these aircraft would be coming to Jetstar. We're very fortunate that our parent granted us the A330s to use in the interim, and now we've got these coming in. These will replace the A330s, which will then go in back into Qantas. It'll help Qantas renew its fleet, and it'll have one of the youngest fleets, I think, in Qantas's history, which is great. And we're delighted to be the carrier of choice for the Qantas Group in bringing the airline, being the Dreamliner, the 800 series, into Jetstar.
It's quite an honour, isn't it?
It is a great honour. We're very proud. We've earned the right. We've worked hard at it. Yep. We've got great people. We worked very collaboratively with Qantas to ensure that our standards as a separate ASC are exactly the same as Qantas standards and rigour and processes, and Qantas has worked alongside us as we've inducted these aircraft alongside CASA, the Jetstar team, the Qantas team, and other regulators, and of course Boeing and GE, whose engines are operating on them.
And are you going to have a simulator here in Australia for the 787?
We will, yes. That was announced a couple of months back. Alan Joyce, Jane Herdlicker, and the Premier announced that there will be a simulator based out at Airport West. It's a huge investment for Victoria. It's great. And that will be suitable for both Qantas and for Jetstar. So we're delighted that we'll get the simulator to match the aircraft here. A lot of our pilots are currently being trained in Seattle and Singapore. It'd be great to have them trained on the simulator and have that here in Airport West in Victoria.
Now, obviously, bringing this one in, this is the first one here, and there's going to be more to follow, I believe, another 13 of them. What sort of routes would we expect to see them operating on?
Yeah, essentially, the Dreamliner replaces the A330. So it'll replace the existing routes. Whereas we get more deliveries, we've got 10 330s at the moment. So delivery 11 onwards, the next 11, 12, 13, 14, 40% increase in capacity, we'll look at routes then, and that'll largely depend on where the demand is. Having a fleet of this size, having the flexibility and agility that Jetstar does, we can timely and decisively move aircraft around to match with market demand. So they'll be inducted over the next 12 to 18 months. By 2015, all 14 should be here, and we'll be looking at markets then that are best suited to the route, that we can offer the lowest fares and the greatest customer proposition.
Now, speaking of these aircraft going into the air, we have a lot of aircraft enthusiasts that listen to our program, and they're going to be wanting to know where the route-proving flights are going. I believe they're heading up towards the Gold Coast. Can you confirm?
Yeah, we've announced earlier that they'll be heading up to the Gold Coast and to Cairns for the proving flights, initially proving flights. Then once it's on our AOC, our Air Operator Certificate, we'll be able to sell commercial flights, and that will help us get the crew hours up for the pilots and for the cabin crew, so we'll be able to leverage commercial flights post the proving flights. And post our satisfaction and the satisfaction of CASA, we'll then be able to launch commercial flights on the Eastern Seaboard. And once we've got the hours up and are satisfied, we'll then be able to launch international services from probably mid-December, certainly before Christmas.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure most of our audience will be out there with their cameras trying to get shots.
Oh, it's exciting. There's a lot of us out there with our cameras today too.
We saw a lot of the crew.
I think it's amazing for the Australian aviation industry. Yep. We're very proud at Jetstar to have the aircraft coming in today. We're very proud to be the carrier, the largest low-fares carrier in Australia, that's transforming Australian aviation and continue to transform and pioneer long-haul aviation with a low-fares carrier.
David, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot for coming out today, guys. Thank you.
So there we are, David Hall and the entire Jetstar executive team. And I tell you what, a lot of other Jetstar employees very, very pleased to see that aircraft here. And ever since that aircraft's been here, it's been nearly a week now as we record this. And there's been a lot of work going on training people, I guess, to use that airframe. One of our favourite Facebook pages, in fact, is the Melbourne Airport Aircraft Spotters Group. And I tell you what, they've been out there documenting in great detail all the training that's been going on with that aircraft. It's been towed from the maintenance centre out to the ramp and back and forth and all over the place. And it's about to start doing some route proving flights, as you heard there in the interview, up the east coast of Australia, up into the Queensland area, where they'll be doing some training for pilots and getting that aircraft ready for commercial service.
They certainly will, mate. They'll be doing a lot of east coast passenger flights, as well as the freebies for the staff to get used to it. And then it's off into the international. And the first route, as we heard, is Bali. And it looks like mid-December, possibly earlier. Interesting to note that the A330s are coming back to Qantas just at the time that their maintenance costs go up. So, yeah, good for Jetstar to offload them and get brand new shiny aircraft. Look, good for Qantas to be able to replace the 767s with the A330s, but the maintenance burden on those A330s, they are kind of older ones, and, well, you know, it will be higher than if they had the shiny 787s for themselves.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. We want to extend a great thank you to Jetstar for inviting us down there, and anytime they want to do that again, Grant, they can do it. In fact, you even got yourself on the radio, I should mention, just before we go, doing an interview about it. You radio star, you.
Well, following in your footsteps, mate, I got interviewed by Glenn Wheeler from the travel show on 2GB in Sydney. And just a short one. It was supposed to be a little bit longer, but coming on at the end of his segment, he was running a bit late. But we squeezed in a little bit of a chat. And in fact, I created a video which has the audio from that chat and some of the video I shot when standing by the runway and on the tarmac and when the 787 arrived.
Yeah, and you can find that on our Facebook page, facebook.com/playingcrazydownunder for those of you who are on Facebook. In fact, I think the entire universe is on Facebook these days. So get over and have a listen to Grant being a radio star, and I'll tell you what, he's trying to catch up to me. That's just not on, mate.
Oh, well, you're leading the way quite a bit. I've got a fair way to catch up, mate.
No problem. As I said, that's everything for this week. We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Well, I think my dog is chiming in on that.
You know, one thing I think is interesting. Did you notice how little we heard from Steve on that segment? And I wonder if there's a correlation there between the yummy Jetstar cupcakes that Grant mentioned at the start and Steve's disappearance during the interview.
Maybe he wasn't feeling so good after eating so many cupcakes.
Maybe just a coincidence. We'll have to find out.
All right, next up is Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment. Peter talks to a French engineer who's designed a new airliner, and he asks for a little bit of help from the listeners. So here's Peter.
This week, we're joined by French designer François de Vatteville, who designed a unique aircraft concept for this year's Paris Air Show. François, welcome to Across the Pond.
Good morning.
Well, thank you for joining me. Why did you develop this aircraft? What was your objective?
Well, it's a type of design that you if a year ago you had to ask me you're gonna design an airliner, I would have never believed you. Something that creeps on you.
Right. Okay. So are you not an aircraft designer then?
No. I'm an architect and an industrial designer.
Right. Okay.
But I'm a pilot, so I like things that fly.
Yeah.
And I'm a very transatlantic person. I live half my life in New York and the other half in Europe.
Right.
So I really need to cross the Atlantic very often.
Yeah.
And I do it with my whole family.
Yeah.
And it's probably my second biggest expense now after housing and rent. It's more expensive than even my car.
Yeah. Okay. So why did you set out to design a new aircraft?
So the idea was to really see how far you could push fuel economy on it. So I started doodling on back of envelopes and calculating drag. And I learned a lot along the way how you calculate drag and how you make it more efficient.
Right. Okay.
And curiosity kind of pushed me to seek how far you could go.
Yeah.
And also being practical, like being able to put people in it, because you really need to put a lot of people inside of an airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have this odd shape where the fuselage is actually quite big because you need to house a lot of people, but you still need this huge wingspan that gives you the performance you want.
Yeah. Well, it looks very futuristic. Is it realistic? Will it fly?
It's not really, I don't think it's really futuristic. It reminds me a little bit of a Lockheed Constellation, or, you know.
Yes, the, yes, it does. Yeah.
The latest models that are, you know, they have these really long straight wings, and they really, at this time, they really needed it because they were able to fly these old airplanes from Los Angeles to London nonstop for 23 hours. I don't know if you imagine.
Yeah.
So it's really, it was back then, it was the way to really fly far without much drag.
Right.
And then with the jet age, the speed became the name of the game. And so airplanes started like to really have swept wings and really fly close to the speed of sound. And yes, it's very realistic in a way because it's a very proven design. There's a lot of gliders that fly with very high aspect ratio wings, and they fly very well.
Yeah.
And I've made already 3 models of it.
Yeah.
Like small models, just to test it, to see how stable it is and how it flies. And so far, the results have been very good. It's very stable. The big fuselage doesn't bother the airflow over the wings.
Yeah.
And the V-tail is also very efficient because it has such a long arm.
Right, okay. So talking a bit about performance and the performance characteristics, by the way, I saw the specification document, and for somebody who's not an aircraft designer, it certainly impressed me. And I know, you know, being an engineer, you would look at those things. But let's talk about the power plant and performance of the aircraft. Okay. How will it be powered?
Well, I decided to power it with an existing engine and not rely on anything that's in plan for the future.
Yeah,
I'm using a CFM56, which is the engine of the A320 and the 737. So it's probably the most produced engine in the world today, and it's actually probably the most fuel efficient. It reaches 0.54 in fuel efficiency, which is excellent for its size. It's a pretty small engine, and it was perfect for my airplane. Actually, as a comparison, it's a 250 passenger airplane. It's 68 meter in span, and it has the drag at cruise of a 737.
Wow!
Why not? So using the same engine is logical.
Yeah. And I suppose that would give the potential for the aircraft in the future even greater efficiency with things like the Neo, the LEAP-X. So there's even more potential for the performance of the aircraft to improve.
Yeah, and even you could go with the turboprops. I think that with turboprops, you could get the fuel burn to go even lower.
You could
cut it down to another third. But the reason why I did with jet turbofans was to not to shock people too much at the beginning.
You know,
I think you have to move from the swept back jetliner to this kind of airplane step by step.
Right, okay.
Being powered by 2 very well-proven turbofans puts people at ease. And if there was, you know, probably 4 or maybe 6 turboprop, it would look so different. Maybe it would scare people off a little bit.
And it does look like a flyable airplane. All the statistics that you've produced, which I'm by no means an expert in, seem to suggest it's going to work. What's been the feedback so far, and how are you going to move this design concept on?
Well, the feedback has been excellent. I didn't plan much for it. It was really a fun exercise, and I teamed with a very talented artist from Australia who did the 3D model of it, and we worked together for 2 months to create this image. And it was just very successful. And he sent it to the Royal Aeronautical Society and to Aviation Week and they immediately published it.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, the feeling was a little bit, I was, as a designer, you never get things published so fast. You know, you always.
Yeah.
And it made me realize that maybe there's a huge creative void in aviation.
Yeah.
That they're jumping on the first thing that looks a little bit different they see. So I don't think I should take the journalistic success at face value.
Right.
I think we're just interested in anything that looks different.
Okay. So what's the future then, Francois?
Well, the future is I'm developing it basically step by step. I'm moving to bigger models. Now I'm making a 2-meter model.
Yeah.
That just to test it, and test it with one engine, test it in side slips, test it with front and rear weight and balance. And after that, I would love to build a 1/4 scale flyable.
Yeah.
So exactly the same design, but it would be 15 meter in a span.
Yeah.
And it would have two small turbojets.
Wow. I really want to see this fly now. I really want to see it move forward.
This was the idea. I really want to see it in, you know, flying too.
Yeah. And,
I can do it basically on my own funds.
Yeah.
And it would be fun. It would be like a home built, but you know, going to the 250 passenger airliner.
Yeah. Well, listen, we look forward to finding out a bit more about the progress you make. Where can we find out more about the project online?
Well, I think with people like you, in journalists. I don't have a website.
Okay.
It would take a lot of time. I'm just working every day a couple of hours here and there on it.
Okay. Well, if anyone wants to find out any more about the aircraft, if they email us, we'll happily pass those details on to you.
Oh, that would be fine. That would be great.
Wonderful. Well, Francois, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm very happy to be here too.
When we finished recording, I had a discussion with Francois, and one of the things that we felt would be really useful is for all you aeronautical engineers and aerospace engineers, if you'd like to have a look at the details, at the breakdown of the performance statistics, and want to analyze them and see if Francois's got his numbers right, please do ring in and we'll send you a copy of the spec sheet and put you directly in touch with Francois.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thanks, Peter.
That's a pretty gutsy thing to do. I'm an architect. I designed an airliner, and I'm going to let aeronautical engineers look at my work and see if it makes any sense.
It's great. I love it when somebody creates.
I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah. So along that, if anyone listening would like to take a look at the specs, this write us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll either provide you with a copy or put you in touch with Francois. I've seen the specs, and they're pretty detailed. They go on for several pages. And if you have some experience with aerospace engineering and that sort of thing and would like to kind of take a look at this and help Francois with his project, please feel free. All right, moving on to listener mail. Rob, do you remember a couple episodes ago we talked about the folks who followed their GPS blindly in Alaska and it led them onto the airport property and then the taxiway and across the runway?
I do recall that specifically. And I think I said something like, why were they able to get onto the airport in general?
Exactly. Well, Mark Newton, being the creative guy that he is, figured out how he could answer that question. And what he did is he used Google Street View and actually zeroed in on that security barrier and sent us a link, which we'll put in the show notes. It lets you see the barrier and what it looks like. And Rob, I tell you, it sure doesn't look like anything that would hold anybody back. I mean, you could just drive around that thing.
I have to admit, I was kind of surprised when I saw that, and it's gate, and if you don't like it, you can just go around it.
Drive around it.
Hello!
Yeah. Oh, so, that's amazing.
That was kind of interesting, but I love it when our listeners do things like that. I mean, luckily they don't take us at everything, at our word on everything. I mean, they like to go into the details quite a bit too, and find the answers. And this is pretty cleverly done. So thank you.
Yeah, great work, Mark. And again, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And it's, you just have to see this picture. It's just, it'll floor you. We heard from Kenneth. Kenneth wrote us a couple of weeks ago asking about test pilots insurance and how that works. When we see Boeing and Airbus and so forth, Bombardier taking test flights on their new aircraft designs, he's wondering how does insurance work for that? And, you know, do the pilots have to get it themselves? Is it part of the company benefits? Just, you know, how does that work? And we tried to find some answers to that, sort of mixed success. We asked Boeing, and actually we did hear back from their communications department. Kate wrote back and said that, well, they don't comment on individual benefits for employees, but did make the case that, of course, Boeing is concerned about safety when it comes to flight testing, and that they have a lot of processes and procedures in place to ensure the safety of the flight and of the test pilots. So I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that, Rob, but I guess in general, when you're talking about a job as a test pilot for a large corporation, I think you're kind of covered under the insurance policies that your employer provides.
Oh, I would imagine. And as the lady from Boeing said, that's all we're going to tell you.
That's right. We did write to a couple of other aviation insurance providers to see if we could get some comments on that. But at least as of this date, we haven't heard back. And if we do on this topic, we'll pass it along. We also heard from Doug on personal electronic devices in aircraft. And maybe Bill will have some examples of instances where that's been an issue or not, maybe with him. But in our last episode, we talked about an incident, Doug says, where a magnetic device, not an electrical device, was affected by uncertified equipment. This was a case where someone in the cockpit was using a smartphone, I guess it was, to take photos. And every time they took a photo, they could see the result of that, or an effect from that, let's say. So again, Doug says that, you know, magnetic device, he says it's well known that this can happen. And FARS 23.1327 and 23.1547 specified that the compass correction card must contain information regarding the state of electrical devices when they interfere with compass readings. He says, note that the fact that a correction card is required is an admission that magnetic compasses are routinely subject to interference. Furthermore, your listener probably only noticed the interference because it varied as pictures with the smartphone were taken. What if his passenger had been carrying a magnetic money clip or something similar? The compass would have had a constant deviation that probably would have gone unnoticed. He says aircraft magnetometers are often mounted in the wing or tail cone of light aircraft in order to be as far as possible from these effects. He says I would expect the same in transport category planes. And then finally, Doug says the real question is whether personal electronic devices interfere with localizers, glide scopes, GPS, comm radios, etc. Circumstantial evidence suggests that they don't. So, Bill, have you? This has been kind of an ongoing conversation in our episodes about the effects or not of personal electronic devices. Do you have any stories as a pilot? Any examples of issues associated with PEDs?
I have not. I don't have any stories of non-compliance with the crew directions to turn them off and resulting adverse effects from that. So considering that I haven't been conducting any tests to say, let's turn them on and see what happens,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to say that one way or the other what's going to happen.
Okay.
I would suspect that the passenger with a magnetic money clip would have no effect whatsoever. It would be my educated guess.
What the heck is a magnetic money clip?
I don't know. Maybe it holds your magnetic money.
You know, I don't know. It's when you want to stick your money to the refrigerator.
Yeah, my cell phone
has a magnetic clasp. My cell phone holder has a magnetic clasp on it. Maybe it's something like that.
Maybe.
Hmm. Well, of course, there is that proposal that just came out from some working group with FAA and somebody else. I just read about it a couple of days ago that they want to get all the PED regulations repealed or restrictions repealed. Of course, whether that's going to happen or not is another story, but it's in the works.
Now, one of the things that was notably not going to be repealed with that was the use of the cell phone for, you know, transmission and reception.
So
you could not talk on your phone or use it and to transmit. But you could, apparently, I guess the idea is you could still use your iPod or your iPad or whatever other non-transmitting device, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, and I think I've said that before, I think it's a wise decision, because the last thing I want to do is get stuck on a flight with some guy next to me shouting into his smartphone, having some kind of inane conversation with who knows who. But so I'm all for that decision.
Well, I think they won't. Frankly, on a practical sense, I don't think they work very well once you gain much in the way of altitude anyway.
Yeah, I don't think they were really designed for that, and I think another argument against them, a technical argument against those kinds of in-flight cell phone calls, is that because you're at that altitude, you can your signal will be picked up by potentially a large number of cell towers, as opposed to when you're on the ground and you're only going to be able to reach a couple of them, and the system doesn't work so well when you have that sort of broad coverage, but. All right, we also heard, again, from Pasadena Brian. He sent us a link to an article, Best Airports for a Long Layover, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Most of those are sort of international airports. Brian also mentioned this kind of crazy trip he took a couple of weeks ago to Singapore. This is one of those whirlwind kind of flights, and it starts out on a Friday. Oh, let's see, Friday morning, it looks like, L.A. to San Francisco, then San Francisco to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Singapore, Singapore to Tokyo, Narita, Narita to San Francisco, San Francisco back to LAX, and that's 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon. So that's basically like 2.5 days with a lot of flights, kind of a whirlwind business trip. I don't know, Rob, have you ever taken anything like that? You haven't done that much international travel, I guess.
Not a huge amount, no. I think the worst one I had was over to Dubai a couple of years ago. And, you know, for somebody like Bill, you probably don't even remember which time zone you're in. But for me, us old guys find it a little more difficult when you advance in age, making those multiple leaps of time zones in a short period of time. So I try to avoid them, actually.
The time zone thing is the hard part. You, for me, you know, as a pilot, I don't have to be awake in the layover. So I don't have to get there and, you know, be awake for the meeting when I get there. So
right.
It's a different situation for us. We have to be awake in the airplane where everybody else is sleeping, and we have to sleep on the layover when everybody else is supposed to be awake doing their business. So it's kind of opposite. But, you know, we can cover a lot of time zones. The next trip I have, for example, start out in the mountain time zone and end up in Mumbai a couple days later. So it definitely plays with your body clock, and that is the challenge with a lot with crew fatigue is trying to manage, you know, where you're not on any kind of circadian rhythm at all.
Yeah. Is there some particular method, some things that you do or don't do, Bill, to try to minimize the negative effects of all those time zone changes?
Kind of look at when I have to get up to go to work and plan my sleep accordingly.
But that's hard because you can't always make your body go to sleep just because you know you should.
Now, sometimes, a lot of times I find myself when I get in from a trip, I'll go to sleep, but I know that I can only sleep for a couple hours because I need to be able to sleep 8 hours, not that long afterward. Mm. So either stay up and try to power through until you can, you know, sleep your 8 hour rest, or just take a short nap, force yourself to get up so that you're not, you know, only able to sleep 2 hours before you go to work, which would not be a good thing.
We had a listener send in a link to another article, Flying Blind passenger lands plane after pilot collapses at controls. And we do see this from time to time where for some reason the pilot of a plane becomes incapacitated and someone has to, either because they're the only one or because they have some abilities, or jump in, fill in for the pilot and land the plane. And I guess this one was a situation like that where I guess it was air traffic control. Was it air traffic control helped this passenger land the plane, which was successful. Do you think it's unusual? You guys are pilots. Is that unusual for a service, someone who doesn't know anything about flying, to be able to follow direction and land a plane like this?
I don't know. I remember not that long ago, there used to be some kind of program. I think it was designed for the spouses of pilots who flew with them to give them enough instruction so that if the pilot spouse became incapacitated, they would know how to call for help and would know how to fly the airplane enough that they could land it.
Yeah, and that's but that is hard. I think the one thing that I took from that story that because I think before the show started, you were asking, you know, what one of the challenges is, and I think it's keeping the person calm. If you can keep the person calm, you have a chance. But if the person is losing their mind up there, it's all over.
Not much you can do.
Yeah, and it is an interesting challenge, though, and you do some of that, I think, as a flight instructor, is to try to put yourself in the shoes of the person that's in command and say, well, this is what you should be doing now. Yeah, I'd be doing that. You can do this. You can add some speed. You can pull the power back. You can point the nose down a little bit. And if you're good, you might be able to make this work. I don't think every instructor can do that, but thank goodness in this case the instructor was. But also, as I said, the person that was flying didn't panic, and that was really important.
Key thing. All right, we'll close out with an email from Tony. We were talking about electronic cigarettes and airline policies regarding those. And Rob, you had found out that, at least in the U.S., I guess that are they banned pretty much across the board?
Well, I know you couldn't use them on Southwest. I mean, I asked them that the other day, and they said, "Are you crazy?" But I don't know, Bill. At your airline, can people use smokeless cigarettes?
I don't think so, but not 100%.
That's because the door's always closed.
I just kind of assume that they're in the "we don't want to go there yet" category.
Tony tells us that it's different at Ryanair. He says since the invention of the electronic cigarette, Ryanair has been selling this product on the aircraft pre-flight by walking the aisles, waving packets of them in your face. So once again, Ryanair is kind of marching to its own tune, this time with electronic cigarettes.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Do they have any odor of any kind at all? I've never been around one, so I'm not really sure.
Our original listener who wrote in, this was concerning, I think, his wife, said that there was a kind of an odor associated with them that, if I recall correctly, that she didn't find particularly pleasant. So, but then again, I think, as Rob, you pointed out, that aren't these things generally producing water vapor and that's it?
I believe that is what they do. But I know I asked that question on Twitter last week when this came up, and Fish, you know, flying with Fish, yeah, said, no, there's nicotine in those things. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe we have some listeners that use them that can tell us about them.
All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank our guest, Bill Palmer.
Thank you.
Understanding Air France 447. Bill, once again, tell our listeners where they can find more about the book, where they can order it, where they can find more about you.
You can look on the book's companion website, understandingaf447.com, which has links to purchase the book there, on Amazon, iTunes, and Barnes & Noble, as well as now at Aviation Universe in Chicago near O'Hare Airport, the stopover store, and I'm trying to get it in more outlets as well.
And you have your own personal blog, don't you?
I do, yes. My personal blog is trendvector.blogspot.com. That's linked from the book's companion page, the Understanding AF447 site. and often discuss Air France 447 related subjects on there as well.
Fantastic. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, this was a lot of fun, Bill. Thanks.
Thanks, Rob.
And we also want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at planecrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson. Find him at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, Rob, let's tell folks where they can find us online.
Well, they can find me at jetwine.com. They can find us at Jetwine on Twitter. They'll find us at who knows where on Facebook. I don't know. Put my name in and see what happens, as David always says. And all kinds of other great places. And of course, we don't have the UAV show that you guys do, Max.
No, we're having a blast with that. That's at theuavdigest.com. You can find me there. Also, look for Max Flight on Google Plus and Twitter. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. We'll have links to all the sites we mentioned, some photos of the different aircraft we talk about. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google Plus. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. Also, you can do that with TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message.
Really? What's the phone number, Max?
Let's ask Aunt Benet.
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. Is David going to be back next week?
He's supposed to be.
Okay. David, we missed you. Okay, see, that's one of the do-overs, Bill. Wait, excuse me. Oh, I had a tickle in my throat there. You know, the all right, let me do that again. Killing plants, bear with us, Bill. We'll cut all this stuff out. So, of course, you know, there would be wives that might be happy to see their husbands take that mission and never come back. But, okay, well, we won't go down that road.
Do you think that would be your case, Rob?
No, of course not. Okay. No. My wife would miss me terribly, I think. Probably. I hope. In fact, can we call? No, I guess we can leave that there. oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Cut that out, Max.
We're trying to get the airplane under control. But, of course, they had lost a lot of airspeed. In fact, as the airplane fell, they pulled the nose up.
Well, now, hey, Bill, I guess something that... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so froggy. It's allergy season out here. You don't have that in San Diego.
They didn't go into what the pilots were doing on their layover or...
Wait, we'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks. I almost forgot to say that. Cheers, folks.
Yeah, I was wondering.
It's what's down under the counts. Oh, hang on, that's your line.
It's been such a long time, mate.
I know.
I don't know anything about them. I never smoked. I mean, I never inhaled. So, okay, we won't go down that road. Okay. Boom, boom.